From WXXI News, this is Weekend Connections, the podcast. Nice to have you along. I'm Evan Dawson.
And I'm Megan Mack. We'll open the week with the next Monroe County executive. Adam Bello won his race against incumbent Cheryl Denolfo. We talked to him about a wide range of issues. This was the clip that stood out. It begins with Evan asking Adam Bello about how familiar he is with the struggles of people in poverty or dealing with addiction.
I don't ask this as any kind of a gotcha or a litmus test, just genuinely curious, because okay. I'm reading a book right now by a journalist named Chris Arnotti, who was going to be on the program this Friday. Listeners, he switched that to December 13th, but he spent more time than anybody I've ever read legitimately living alongside and getting to know people in what you might call America's forgotten communities, hollowed out factory towns, parts of the New York City area where people on Wall Street, used to work on Wall Street, are told you can't go, drug houses where you can't go. It is a genuine effort in his book called Dignity to look at the lives of people who are really hurting and suffering and, frankly, people who have needles in their arms a lot.
Yeah.
And it made me ask this question about myself, so I'll ask you the same question. When you think about opioids, when you think about economic development and poverty and jobs and opportunity, how much time do you spend talking to people who are actually suffering at the quote-unquote bottom?
That's a really good question. Not enough, honestly, but I will give you one of the most impactful things that happened to me in the campaign. And it came about 2 weeks before Election Day. I was knocking on doors off North Clinton Avenue on Scranton and Conkey and North Clinton, right around St. Michael's Church. And we were right across the street from a park, which is largely known as Ground Zero for the opioid epidemic. And there's moms walking their babies on the sidewalk and with the strollers, and there's just people out. And I'm looking across the street. I had a meeting with some folks at the Father Tracy Center right there about opioids. And I said, what are these people doing across the street? They were sort of gathering in these tight circles. Sure enough, they were doing drugs, like right in the open air. It was bright daylight outside. And, you know, it sort of hit me. We need to be here more. Why is that the first time I'm seeing this? You know, there's an opioid task force that exists in the county right now, and they meet in nice, you know, conference rooms, and they meet where they meet, which is great. And I'm really looking forward to joining task force and working on this. But we should be meeting there. We should be meeting there so we see it, so we see what's going on in this park and on this corner. And then when I went and knocked on doors around that block, the constant refrain I heard from people was that they said, and these were great people, greatest people you meet in your life, but they're obviously struggling economically and they're struggling with the drug crisis that's happening outside their doors. And they said, Adam, we'll vote for you and we'll support you because we've never really seen a county official here before and people asking for our votes. But they said, you can't forget us. You have to come back. You have to come back because we need help. And they're right. They have to see their county officials, their elected officials there. They have to see that the government's working for them, or else you start to breed this sense of hopelessness. And once that sets in, it's very difficult to change. And, you know, the very next week, I went back to that park. There was an announcement for this La Marqueta development that was happening right across the street. And I was really happy to be there that day because, you know, they kept saying we need help. And it looks like, you know what, help is on the way. It's, you know, there's a new development happening in that park that hopefully will chase some of that activity out. But I wanted to make sure that I came right back to that neighborhood because that really was looking at the faces of these people just begging me to come back, some of these residents. I have to come back.
Next, we had an extraordinary hour with two people who likely never expected to become friends. Arno Michaelis was a white supremacist who founded a racist gang in Milwaukee. Pardeep Malenka was an Indian American immigrant and a member of the Sikh religious community there. Michaelis grew to realize his bigotry was wrong, and he quit the gang that he founded. Years later, he saw a news alert. A member of that white supremacist gang he founded had killed six people in a mass shooting in a Sikh temple. Pardeep's father was one of the victims.
Michaelis decided to reach out to Pardeep to apologize and take responsibility for founding that white supremacist gang, even if he had long since moved away from it. Together, the two men wrote a book about overcoming hate. In this clip, Michaelis tells us about what moved him to become a high school bully and then a white supremacist, and what might prevent other kids from going in that direction.
I don't think the issue was so much attention. I got a ton of attention, almost too much attention. My earliest memories, all the adults in my life would be gushing about what a brilliant, gifted genius I was and how wonderful I was. And I think because I was witnessing my mother's suffering and not feeling wonderful, I kind of set out to say, well, I'm not wonderful. I'm horrible. And if you don't believe me, watch what I'm going to do to this kid. Like, watch what I'm going to do to your school. And I think my antisocial behavior was more a matter of stimulation. Hmm. Yeah, I was looking for something, for thrills. Alcoholism is a genetic disease, and a very common trait of alcoholics is being an adrenaline junkie, which I was from day one. And there can be healthy ways to manage that, but I didn't manage it in a healthy way. And I should say, I failed miserably to engage with all sorts of healthy ways that were offered to me. And I just kept kind of gravitating back towards negative ways. And I don't know that it was really I needed attention. It was just I needed to blow off steam. I needed to keep myself amused. And looking back, a lot of it was very sociopathic. I mean, I was a pretty messed up kid. That's what started the antisocial behavior. And as I grew up, it just I needed to keep escalating it to kind of get the same thrill. As an alcoholic myself, I recall the first time I drank beer at age 14, I probably had four or five beers and passed out. And when I quit drinking 20 years later, my magic number was 18 beers. That's how much beer I could drink in an evening and still function the next day. So it's an example of the escalating amount of substance you need to get high. And as a kid, my substance was pissing off teachers, scaring kids, like creating fear, creating chaos. And it always needed to escalate. So that's what brought me to the point where I was 16 and already a full-blown alcoholic, accustomed to violence. I'd been violent since I was a little kid, and hate was just another part of the rush. And that's who I was when I was exposed to white nationalist ideology via white power skinhead bands.
So music with sort of hate speech. And again, let me just sort of pause and ask you a question on this particular layer of your life. We hear some people talk about kids who are 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, who are bullies or who bully other kids. And I want to be careful with sort of that person first language, but who bully other kids, who hurt people in probably the same ways that you did. And sometimes we say, well, that's a bad kid. And I'm always careful about that because you never know what someone is going through. You want people to be accountable. You want people to be responsible. But how do you feel about this urge that some people have to say, well, that kid's just a bad kid?
Well, I definitely appreciate your mindfulness there because I kind of live by the truth that hurt people hurt people. Mm-hmm. It's actually like a tool you can use on a day-to-day basis, is whether it's somebody just cutting you off in traffic or somebody being really hateful and violent. You remind yourself they're acting that way because they're suffering. And that doesn't mean it's okay. It doesn't mean it's acceptable. It doesn't mean you lie down and take it. But it just means that you understand that that behavior comes from suffering, and it allows you to respond with compassion rather than aggression, which is only going to feed the behavior. And actually, the aggression is what those people are trying to provoke. So it comes down to a tactical approach. If you want to prevail in this conflict, you can't let your opponent make the rules. And if you respond to aggressive people with aggression, you're literally putty in their hands.
Yeah, and the reason I'm kind of interjecting here to ask about this particular part of your life is because I'm thinking about kids, hurt kids now, who maybe have, every kid's different, every person's different, but similar circumstances to yours. I'm worried about what the future of their life looks like. I'm worried about what the present of their life looks like. And you say that some of the interventions offered to you didn't really work, that you didn't take them. Do you think anything would have worked with you, and do you think we need to do different things for kids who are suffering now?
Yeah, absolutely. What I really have a lot of confidence would have worked for me would have been martial arts. I think there's a huge gender component to violent extremist ideologies, largely that it's men who don't know, or males who don't know what healthy masculinity looks like. The kind of buzzword of toxic masculinity gets thrown out a lot now, and I think that can be counterproductive. Is you're letting the problem dictate the terms. So again, like being about what's healthy masculinity look like, and in my case, I think martial arts would have accomplished that. Growing up, I did live in a well-to-do suburb, and I had a nice house. And by world standards, my family was incredibly wealthy. But by the standards of my suburb, I was like the poor kid. And all my friends took taekwondo and karate, and I was like obsessed with anything Asian and anything having to do with martial arts. And my parents just couldn't afford to send me. And so there was a lot of angst about that. I was angry about that. And then one summer through the rec program, there was a six-week judo course for like $75 or something. And my parents put me in, and I was so stoked. And my sensei was a woman who was an Olympic judokan. And she was pretty slight, but this is a class of adults and kids, and she would just like be whipping grown men around like it was nothing. And at that point, there was not an adult in my life that I would listen to or that could command my attention or my discipline. But when I was just in the presence of this woman, I was just standing there at attention, like waiting for her order. And I loved judo, and I was pretty good at it. And I got my orange belt in 6 weeks. I was in tournaments, and all I wanted to do was continue. But then after the 6 weeks, they're like, yeah, it's $75 a week now. So that my parents couldn't afford that, and it kind of had a definitely opposite effect, because now I'm like really angry that I can't continue with judo, but I'm like more dangerous than I was. And even going into as a teenager, I used a lot of the fighting moves I was taught without retaining the real spiritual kind of Zen warrior aspect of martial arts. So I think with a good teacher, martial arts is a really powerful way to divert young men from violence. And it's important to understand, too, that like testosterone is not going anywhere. You got to manage it. And sometimes for some kids, that means rough stuff is the best way to do it. So martial arts, football, hockey, wrestling, those things, if they're done with a coach or a trainer who really addresses the spiritual aspect of it as well, it can be a great way to sort that out.
Next, we welcomed an Afghan refugee named Mushtaba Haidar. He came to the United States on something known as an SIV, a special immigrant visa. SIVs are awarded to Iraqis and Afghans who have served the U.S. military in some fashion. Often they're translators, but sometimes they do other work. Mushtaba was well-educated and raising a family of three children with his wife in the Afghan capital of Kabul. He worked for years in the American military, helping with translation, contracts, field work, and more. Eventually, he was marked for assassination by the Taliban. He knew he was no longer safe in Afghanistan.
Trying to escape, Mushtaba and his family boarded a boat with dozens of other people. That boat capsized, and while he was able to save one son, he lost contact with his wife and two other children. He tells his story in this clip. You'll also hear from Ellen Smith, director of Keeping Our Promise, a program of refugees helping refugees. Here's Mushtaba.
In 2015, when I decided to leave Afghanistan to go to a safe place, I had my wife, my daughter, and my two sons. So when I found out that we cannot be anymore in Afghanistan safe, so I decided to leave from Afghanistan to Turkey.
How old were the kids?
At that time, my daughter was 9, my middle son was 7, and my younger son was 3.5. So we decided to take a boat and cross from Turkey to Greece. Unfortunately, we couldn't meet that in the ocean, in Aegean Sea. Our boat sank in the water. It was around 9 o'clock at night. Since that moment, I couldn't find my wife, my daughter, and my son. I could only rescue my son. His name is Shahzad.
I'm so sorry about that. I mean, I don't know what else to say, Mushtaba. How many people were on the boat? How large of a boat was it that sank?
It was not a rubber boat. It was a wooden boat. So around 50 to 48 people.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, from different countries, from Iraq, from Algeria, from Afghanistan.
Yeah. It must have been a lot of chaos in that situation. Just trying. How far were you from shore? How did you? get sort of you and your son, how were you able to get to safety?
We've been sitting in, next to each other. Me, my son, my wife, my daughter. Mm-hmm. My younger son was with my friend inside the cabin. The boat crashed with a big wave. In a second, we found ourselves inside the water. As far as my son was next to me, I hold his hand and made him to underwater. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. He had life jacket, so I tried to go back inside the sea while it was in the water to catch my wife, my daughter, my son. Unfortunately, I couldn't find any of them since that moment. After my incident, it took me 3 years to get my visa. It was October 25th, 2018 that I resettled here in Rochester.
So you've been here for just over 1 year.
Yes.
What did you find in Rochester? How has it been for you?
I feel safe. I feel really home.
That's a powerful statement. I wish you could see Ellen Smith's the smile on her face. That's what it's supposed to feel like, isn't it?
Yes. I mean, that's our goal, is that we want to create a welcoming, loving community for these families. That's been my goal for 5 years. It's all for one and one for all.
How is your son doing?
He's good. He's getting adjusted with the community, and he's really happy being in here.
How old is he now?
10. 2 months ago, it was July, we went to Europe. Though we had a lot of family members and relatives, but now, I mean, he don't want to go back to Europe. He always say, I'm good here.
Is it because he feels safe, secure, he's happy here?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, and is he at the international school?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, one of the great treasures that people don't realize of Rochester is that we have the Rochester International Academy. And that is a school specifically designed for refugee children, for children that have been through trauma, who don't speak English. And they go there for 2 years and have a great support network. And that's just not available in all these other cities where refugees resettle. So there are great opportunities here for these families. There's the OASIS program, mm-hmm. so they can get into skilled trades. But in terms of the children, I mean, it's just, this is a wonderful city, and the support that we have for refugee children who have gone through trauma.
Mushtaba, I my understanding is that, you know, understandably so, you have not wanted to give up on the idea that your wife and two other children, you know, you weren't able to find them after you lost the boat, but
yep.
But you haven't necessarily, you didn't want to give up on that. How do you feel now?
As far as I couldn't find their dead bodies, so still I hope they are alive. It took me, I was in Turkey searching for them over all the hospitals, mm-hmm. graves, and morgues. I searched everywhere in Turkey. At the same time, my relatives, my family were searching Europe side, Greece side on that time. Still, I couldn't convince myself. Last July, I went myself again to Lesbos, Iceland, and did again the search. I went through all the possible sources that if I can find anything. The problem is that in 2015, in Greece, there was no any proper database of registration of who was crossing the sea from Turkey to Lesbos. So finally, again, I ended up with no result, but still, I wish they are alive and I can find them one day.
Good luck to you.
Thank you.
What do you hope for in terms of your Rochester future? This is home now, you say.
Yes.
Well, I'm glad to hear that.
Thank you.
What do you want to do here?
Definitely, I want to be an active part of my society and community. Now I got all support from my community. I'm trying to, I hope I can give back to them soon.
Let's close the hour with Black Joy. That's the name of a bi-monthly yoga program in Rochester, specifically designed for people of color, taught by people of color. It's offered by Yoga for a Good Hood, a business started by Imani O'Lear. She joined us to talk about inclusivity in the wellness industry.
During that hour, we took a phone call from a listener named John, who wanted to know why it's okay to offer a yoga class for only people of color. You'll hear that call and then responses from Imani O'Lear, a yoga teacher named Ashley Cowart, and Daniel Ponder, a yoga student and musician. Here's John's call.
I'm very glad to hear you talking about wellness and inclusion. My only comment today is the fact that the people in the studio have said they feel uncomfortable with classes led by a white instructor. What they're doing is starting a class, and they said it's only for brown or black people, is what the person in the studio made the comment. To me, that seems like almost the exact definition of racism, is they are starting a class and excluding one race of people based on skin color. So I love the fact that we're talking about wellness and inclusion, but I would like their comment on why they are starting a class for only brown and black people.
Okay, John. Thank you. Imani, you want to start?
Sure. So at Yoga for a Good Hood, it is a space where everyone is welcome. We have persons that are of color and persons of poverty, and we know that poverty hits all persons. But there is also a need for space to be able to articulate safely some of the frustrations that is unique to persons of color. I go to a lupus support group. Everybody in the room has lupus, and everybody has some conversation around that. Black and brown bodies have different things that have been affecting their breath that they need to safely be able to articulate. Sometimes that's difficult in the run of the week. And so Black Joy is a space to be able to, like, enjoy who you are and how you move. And like, when you start talking about even like with the language in a class about, all right, let's try to loosen our, let's try to tighten our booties. Well, as Black women, I want my booty to be full. And I want to be able to have that discussion safely, right? And it's just a different cultural expression. It's not about excluding someone. Think of it as a way to just create space for those who just need to just be with one another. That's all.
Would it be different if, you know, would you feel differently if someone said all yoga and all spaces should be divided by race?
No, I wouldn't feel comfortable with that at all.
Right. That's so.
Right.
So to John's point, there's plenty of space and locations and spaces in this society right here where people can go
During the week, that is a truth for us. But this special class is so that we can just sit and support each other. Ashley.
And to kind of like try to go off what Imani said, I've had a couple of occasions where we had to talk about race and we had to talk about the discrimination against African Americans, and I didn't feel comfortable to voice how it made me feel. I work with all white clients and taking care of them, and they're calling me niggers and they're calling me blackie. And then to come into a space where, like, okay, I had this happen. You don't know what I feel. Mm. You don't know what I suppress. You don't know how I put on a smile. But then how do I deal with that and get that out of my body and still be able to do my job? Coming into Black Joy, I think it just helps you deal with the stuff that you face out in the world. And then we get to kind of like debrief in this space. But we also get to like feel okay to do it. Like, I feel like sometimes if I say, like, oh, I was someone I was discriminated against, I don't feel comfortable saying that because it makes me look like a victim. And I don't, and they say we always cry victim. So that, to me, when I go to Black Joy tomorrow, I'm going to take all the stuff that I had to deal with from this week, last week, months before that, and I'm going to put it all on my mat, and I'm going to leave it.
And that's another edition of Weekend Connections, the podcast. You can hear Connections every weekday afternoon from noon to 2 on WXXI AM 1370, WRUR 88.5 FM, and WEOS, that's Finger Lakes Public Radio, 89.5 FM.
We are also on the WXXI mobile app. He's Evan. I'm Megan. Have a great weekend, everybody. We'll talk to you Monday.